Wow, it's the Babe Lab people! That's so exciting!
You're listening to the Babe Lab podcast. What? Babe Lab? Babe Lab. Babe Lab. Yeah, you're listening to the Babe Lab podcast.
The best.
Babes in the lab?
Babe?
No, Babe Lab.
Speak up, son.
Speak up, son.
Are we on?
Speak up.
Yeah, we're on. Oh.
So welcome to the Babe Lab podcast, episode 17, the best looking podcast out there on the internet,
because it's all audio.
Come listen to our uninformed opinion about science. So today we're recording from Humphreys on Bank Street, and I'm the AC, and I'm having, what am I having?
A pint.
A pint of
Saint-Ambroise.
Pale. That's right. Which is one of my favorite beers, actually, so I should remember.
I'm drinking Stella. It's good.
I'm the Camel. I'm drinking Saint-Ambroise Oatmeal Stout, which is a Guinness-like concoction.
So, yeah, we have, we have Tony here with us, as usual. Who's drinking Coca-Cola?
Yeah, I have, like, a can of Coca-Cola, because I had enough beers last night.
Yeah, and it's a good week for podcasting because we have another guest on the podcast this week. We've got Russell Taylor.
Hello.
Who's going to be pulling some teeth?
Is it Alfred Russell Taylor?
So, yeah, we were thinking about kicking it off. So, Russ is in dentist school.
Right.
School to be a dentist.
And you're finishing up
right torture now, right? School.
Yeah. He's also a veteran of grad school, though.
Yes.
Say that just so, you know, people don't.
Yeah, actually, I don't actually have any idea what you did in grad school. Want to just give us a quick lowdown on, like, the grad work?
Sure. So I was at Ottawa U. I did a master's here. My lab was actually out at Tony's Pasture at Health Canada. So I didn't get to interact much with the Ottawa U campus.
So that explains your poor social skills.
I did come over for classes, though, which was fun. And my work was, I worked on cytochrome P450, and what I found was a novel promoter element in the gene, which was kind of cool.
So which cytochrome P450?
CYP1A2.
182?
182.
182. I don't know that one.
That's a good one.
I heard there's a new promoter element. That's not the big one. I think that's CYP, either 2D6 or... I can't remember.
I'm more familiar with the ones that are in the steric biosynthesis pathways, so
yeah.
CYP17, SCC, and 19, and all those.
So that was fun. I did my master's. I actually finished that up midway through my second year, actually, at McGill. I finished. And yeah, so I transitioned from science here to dentistry school. That was 3 years ago now. So
3 years ago?
So you must be close to finish then, like one more year? Yep, one more year. Quite looking forward to being done.
And there's no residency or anything? You just start hacking teeth right away?
Yeah, I mean, you can do a residency if you want it, and they actually encourage most people to do a residency. I think I'll probably do some kind of residency. It's a pretty good deal. It's just kind of like a postdoc. You get paid a decent amount of money. And
we have a few residents here at the Bay Lab.
Yeah.
You can apply for the Bay Lab if you want.
Be the blab dentist. So do you plan on specializing at all, or not right away? A lot of people are really excited to specialize, so there's lots of areas you can specialize in. Periodontics, orthodontics is quite popular. Oral surgery is another specialty. That's kind of cool. But for myself, I enjoy all the techniques of dentistry thus far, so I think I'll do general dentistry.
So when you say do a residency, does that mean that you, like, practice with someone who has a clinic already set up, or do you use this hospital thing?
Yeah, most of the time, I mean, you can do private-based residencies,
yeah.
But a lot of them are hospital-based, and it's kind of cool. You just sort of, you'll see more complex...
Yeah, more diversity and more, yeah.
Exactly,
sure.
Exactly. So that's a good experience. I think it'll push you beyond what you would normally see,
yeah.
Have to deal with in your day-to-day practice. So,
yeah. So how long would you do that for? Just like a year or something?
Yeah, they're usually 1 to maybe 2 years. I mean, if you want to do orthodontics, I looked at orthodontics once, and it was 21 months residency to become an orthodontist. And oral surgery, that would be the major commitment, and that's...
Everybody all right, drinks?
Yeah, I'll have another one, please.
I'll have another one, too, please. Probably doesn't look like I need another one, but...
It's inevitable.
I do.
He's got the shakes this morning.
So what made you progress from being a grad student with a master's and go into dentistry?
Well, that's a good question. I actually struggled with it for quite a long time. I found out that I got in, I believe it was February 2004, and I didn't decide for a good month or two. I really enjoyed science. I guess I looked to my supervisor as a bit of a mentor, and I thought what he was doing was really cool. I don't know, I guess I was scared about getting older in science and not having having to work harder no matter what stage you are in your career in science, whereas dentistry posed more of a, as you get older, you can work less, you become more business oriented, you essentially can run the practice and just do what you want from home.
It's a better lifestyle.
Yeah,
it's part of the.
It was, to be honest, it was primarily a lifestyle decision.
And do you still feel that you're using what you've gained from your scientific training?
Yeah, like it was really hard the first year, especially with a lot of the non-evidence-based dentistry practice.
Wow,
non-evidence-based.
We gotta hear about that. So yeah, we'll discuss this further.
Sure. it was definitely difficult going back to lectures. I mean, when you're used to, you know, showing up when you want to show up and leaving when you want to leave, having a tight schedule is pretty difficult. Multiple choice exams, man, that was tough to get back into, but I'm pretty used to it.
Cool.
Should
we start hitting the posts?
Oh yeah, but we have some questions about dentistry that I'd like to ask.
Okay, sure, yeah, why not?
Sure.
Yeah.
Or do we put it as part of the next post?
Oh, it doesn't matter.
Okay, yeah, whatever. Yeah, it's just drill him.
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
drill him. Well, I want to hear about the non-evidence-based dentistry.
Yeah, what's this non-evidence-based dentistry?
So there's some things that, I don't know, There is a lot of evidence-based dentistry coming out, especially in the field of periodontics. So gum disease, gum inflammation, this kind of business is quite evidence-based. Some of the concepts in orthodontics, in particular when I was starting out, were a little bit difficult to swallow. For example, basically all we know most of what is performed or is considered standard care in orthodontics is based on these studies that were done very subjectively. So orthodontics wanted to come out with what's the ideal position for teeth. And so they just chose 100 skulls of what they thought were the ideal teeth angulation and alignment, and essentially based all of
the
orthodontics, based on these models, which were all white individuals.
There's a problem also if you average that, you know, the teeth might not fit with the actual structure that you have, which might be unique, you know, of your bones.
Exactly. So, I don't know. It was difficult learning about you know, well, when they say, "Oh, this is normal," like, well, how can you say that is a normal occlusion? Like the way your teeth fit together when 25% of Asians have the opposite of that and they're healthy. There's no problem.
Yeah.
So I guess a lot of this cosmetic-based dentistry is kind of difficult to swallow because it's not evidence-based.
So would you be more comfortable if they did that just for, you know, white people and they collected 100 skulls for Asian people and then so there's Asian orthodontics and like sort of start splitting up, you know?
I guess that would be an interesting way to go. like, I know things have diversified a lot since then, and I mean, there's more styles for cosmetic orthodontics and stuff, but it's just interesting. The foundations were based, like, on this 100-patient study that,
so did you say that most of the rationale for, like, the ideal tooth configuration or whatever is based on cosmetic considerations, or also, like, sort of, is it, I mean, because they kind of tell you that when you're a kid and you go to the orthodontist, that, like, oh, you know, you're going to have all these deformities and, like, it's going to be a, you know, it's medically necessary, basically, that you have all these rearrangements done to your teeth because your jaw is going to change. Is it more cosmetic, you think?
It's pretty much, at least what I've been taught, we take a class in public health, and what they've taught us is that all orthodontics, essentially, except for a couple exceptions, such as cleft palate and stuff, is aesthetic only. There's no functional, you know, you're not going to develop insane pain in your joints if you don't have this perfect occlusion.
Occlusion meaning like your bite.
The way your teeth come together. Right. Yeah.
So I've got a broad question. I went to a seminar recently where it was a mix of medical doctors and scientists, and one of the doctors that was talking about evidence in medicine, he estimated that evidence-based medicine is about 10-15% of what happens in medicine. Do you have any kind of idea? What would you say how it compares with medicine and dentistry?
With dentistry, well, that's a.
Do you think it's more or less?
I think 10% evidence-based.
Yeah, that's ridiculous. Surprising to me too.
I would like to think it's a bit more than that, though. I will say that I think the trend is towards less evidence-based.
Less evidence-based.
Well, in terms of procedures being carried out, because of our shift is becoming more and more towards cosmetic dentistry, and it's more and more consumer-driven. So, you know, like, more and more people are asking for whitening. More and more people are asking for orthodontics.
Follows the, you know, more private, like, dentistry. Like, do you know of anybody who's practicing back in the day? Apparently, like, quite a bit of dentistry used to be covered, like, you know, by the government. Which would make sense. You know, if you want to prevent, like, you know, serious oral, you know, have good oral health, like, to prevent other problems later on, like, it makes sense. You know, and, you know, do you think this is, like, the cause of, like, some shifts in, like, the way dentistry is going, or... Because I guess you probably don't know anybody who's been around since public dentistry, I'm sure. But
yeah, I know right now in Quebec, kids under 12, I believe, are still covered.
Really?
For limited treatment.
That's pretty cool.
And in the UK also, they're still covered under the public system.
Have they certainly needed?
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, if we're asking questions... Sure. So my dentist, who I just signed up for recently, I love my old dentist. He was like his attitude was, yeah, for sure, everything is cosmetic. Like, you know, I can help you out. He has four sons, and none of them have ever been to the dentist. Anyways, I mean, he knows, he's a good dentist. But, you know, he's just like, you know, help me out when I need help. And this other guy that I go to is totally different. He wants to do everything, right?
He's a proactive.
But not only that, yeah, he's a proactive dentist. Have you ever heard of this? And maybe it's totally legit, but he's like pointing out a particular spot in the back of my mouth where I've had a small bit of previous dental work, I guess.
Okay.
And he's like, there's this like spot here that is probably going to form a cavity at some point. We should get it drilled out now and fill it in.
It's
now.
A preemptive drilling.
This is preemptive attack on a future cavity. I mean, what do you... I know you don't want to, like, it's kind of not so great to judge someone because you haven't looked at it yourself. But, like, you know, what do you think about that? Like, does that sound weird to you? Because it sounded weird.
Interventionist.
To me. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things with dentistry that's really a lot different than science, is that there's this huge margin of what they classify as clinical judgment. So, And clinical judgment just varies so much between individual to individual. And, I mean, to give your dentist some credit, it's true. I mean, when there's an area of decay beginning, it's difficult to clean that out. Eventually, it's going to turn into further decay that you'll have to, like a cavity, essentially, that you'll have to restore. But it's just a what's the benefit? Like, the benefit of doing it now is, okay, you can stop it, fine, and seal it off. The risk is that your treatment now won't last as long as if you had just left it, because these fillings fall out for whatever reason, they re-decay. So that's where his clinical judgment will be coming in. And yeah, some people are more aggressive in their judgment
than others. Yeah, I mean, I guess I have to give him the benefit of the doubt. He certainly has, he knows more about it than I do. And,
yeah.
I mean, I guess a lot of it is experience, and he's like, you know, not old, but he's probably seen some cavities and stuff before. But anyways, I thought that was just sort of weird.
So yeah. What did you decide? Are you going to preemptively drill?
Well, I'm only covered for, you know, X amount of visits per year or whatever. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I can't, they keep on phoning me saying you're due for a cleaning.
Yeah.
And, you know, I can only get clean whatever at once every 8 months or whatever the hell it is, you know, so, you know, I can't go in yet, so I don't even answer their phone calls, because they call all the time, but he's very into it. what are the other questions we had?
About fluoride, so
yes.
Recently I was reading that where this whole fluorination of water thing started, and I don't know if this is correct, but this is what I read, that apparently the initial observation was that it was farmers who used fluorinated water onto crops that somehow had better teeth, and this led to the hypothesis that maybe fluorinated water prevented tooth decay.
This is naturally fluorinated water from the minerals in the, in the rocks.
Oh, okay.
And so then what they did is they added fluoride to the water supply of a particular village, and there was an adjacent village where they didn't add fluoride, and then they looked at cavities and they just like surveyed the people for a number of years, and then they saw some statistically significant differences between these two populations.
Could I have a new one, please?
And eventually they just switched everybody to fluoride because it seemed to be working, except that after the fact there's a number of criticism to that original piece of research. One, that they didn't adjust the social economic factors, so you know it could have been that one village was richer or had a different diet or something like that. The other criticism is that they actually didn't survey them for a very long time, so that there's no good idea of what happens when you give fluoride to long term, like to through the life and even of an individual.
Overall health versus oral health.
Yes, and over several generations, or if there's anything that happens like that, so that. You know, fluoride, adding fluoride to water, maybe not so evidence-based.
But there must be evidence now, right? Because there's lots of people that...
For sure, and I have read some stuff showing...
Drink well water or whatever.
Yeah, I have read some studies where they show, like, lots of data from different places, and they show that, there is a slight advantage, like, in terms of less, you know, cavities and... These are different caries, is the word they use. With people who have fluorinated water. But again, all these studies are just about oral health. They don't talk about anything else, which, I don't know. So it's interesting, like, why they saw oral health as so important that they needed to fluorinate the water. You'd think they'd talk about the other health issues that might be. Do you know anything about, like, fluoride?
Yeah, I mean, we've taken classes on this. And it's interesting because we were presented with the same papers as you read about the two towns. And, I mean, the evidence is pretty convincing for preventing decay just in the last generation.
Could you not also attribute that to, say, you know, the fluoride that's in our toothpaste now as opposed to in our water?
Yeah. So that's true as well. The question, I guess the issue is, people that don't brush their teeth using fluoridated toothpaste, should they still have access? Should they still be getting fluoride through water? Yeah.
So, but anything you've seen, you've never seen any statistics on the benefits in other terms of other health.
I haven't seen any.
Would you expect? You wouldn't expect it to have benefits in other aspects, would you? You mean consequences?
Consequences or benefits?
Because you have fluoride in your water that makes your teeth cleaner, or whatever fluoride does to your teeth.
Fluoride apparently causes mineralization on your teeth.
But because you have better teeth, you have other health benefits. Is that what you mean?
No, no, but you're consuming all this fluoride, right?
Just direct benefits from fluoride.
Like, fluoride's a pretty potent, like,
apparently it accumulates in your bones.
Yeah, it does accumulate in your
bones. So you could have benefits, you could have side effects.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Too.
And fluoride is highly reactive, too.
And, yeah, well, highly electronegative, which I think is the basis for its, you know, enzymatic inhibition problem.
But the way I understand it, the way it's in water, it's in a fairly inert fluoride.
Yeah, and it's, I believe it's like 1 part per million, so it's quite low dose.
But what, I mean, it's fine to say that the actual dose is small, but that doesn't mean anything about its bio effects, especially over the course of an entire lifetime drinking fluorinated water. I don't know.
I guess, you know, you would argue that, you know, it's been happening for so long, you know, like, you know, maybe we could be healthier, but we all feel pretty good, like, you know.
So far, I don't feel fine.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, that's probably the kind of, but that's probably the kind of thinking that, you know.
Yeah.
Do you have any idea what the rate of fluorosis would be, like?
Well, fluorosis is on the rise, actually, because,
what's fluorosis?
So fluorosis is an excess of fluoride.
In your body?
I don't recall the systemic symptoms of fluorosis, but dentally what you see is sort of white spotting of the teeth. The teeth can become brittle in extreme cases.
So that's because they're over-mineralized? Is that the idea?
Yeah, so your teeth are made of hydroxyapatite, and what happens is fluoride replaces one of the hydroxyl groups, I believe, and basically renders the calcium or hydroxyapatite less soluble, especially less soluble to acid. So this is major carioprotective or protective against cavities. But it's also slightly weaker than normal hydroxyapatite. So this fluorohydroxyapatite is less strong. So in the initial studies that David was looking at, they saw people that had excess fluoride. They had these white spotted teeth.
They got patches on the skin also sometimes.
Yeah, and fractured teeth because it's quite brittle, but yet these people had no signs of decay. So that was how they kind of made the link to, okay, fluoride will prevent decay. I understand, like, systemic altercations of excess fluoride or of fluoride may be detrimental, but I think what a lot of people don't realize is that caries is, like, quite a public health risk. Like, it's one of the most infective processes, or the most common infections that humans have.
What's
cavity? So cavity is a very common infection in humans, and so though there may be some side effects of fluoride, which are unknown, the risk to benefit of having systemic fluoridated water greatly outweighs any minor side effects that might be observed.
Is there a particular, like, is it just a general bacterial infection, or is there a particular type of bacteria that cause cavities?
Yeah, so...
And is there another way of treating it, other than, if somebody is just beyond the point of dental repair, can you give them antibiotics, I guess, or something?
Well, for cavities, not so much. For periodontal disease, which is bacterial infection of the gums, there are other treatments. For cavities themselves, what generally happens is a bacterial plaque that forms, so you get a biofilm of a flora, and as the biofilm accumulates, you get more and more acidogenic bacteria, so bacteria that start producing acid and erode away your mineral on your tooth, and that will eventually reach the inner aspect of the tooth, which can infect the nerve and the soft tissue surrounding. In fact, you can see pictures of people with bad dental infections that have large swellings of their soft tissue. It can spread into your throat and collapse your airway. Wow. It can get pretty extreme. I mean,
well, I mean, for sure they've, you know, people have died of this in the past, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's what, you know, I guess that's why fluoride is maybe now an issue, is because it's of the past in some ways, because of, well, at least here, and most people who are reasonably affluent in the Western world, like, we all brush our teeth at least once a day with fluorinated toothpaste, and, like, you know, sure, we might have some cavities that can cause some problems, for sure, like, despite brushing my teeth, I still get cavities, but, you know, I guess the question is, at some point, are we fluorinating our water in the Western world? Is that, yeah, but anyways.
Is there any better ways to, like, fight infections? Is there no antibiotic or any, like, rational drug design? For something that actually acts on the bacteria rather than, like, the consequence of the bacteria?
You're saying that antibiotics don't really work?
Antibiotics won't generally work on dental plaques because dental
plaques... Is it the biofilm effect?
Exactly. It forms a microenvironment that, you know, feeds itself and protects itself.
Keeps
from
out the antibiotics.
Exactly.
Certainly systemic antibiotics, I'm sure, because they're not, you know, directly injured.
So what we need is antibacterial toothpaste.
Or scope, or, like, some kind of a...
Yeah, that's true, actually.
Or if you could, like, scrape it off and, like, drill it and, like...
Fire up the drill.
I mean, it works pretty well. That's, like, our, you know...
I went to an interesting talk... real scientific talk on dentistry, and they were talking about this issue of how plaque control is mechanical removal of plaque seems like so old fashioned. Like, when are we gonna get on from this?
Yeah.
There are
the dentists make their money, like, sitting in the chair for X number of hours, and
there are some ideas towards moving there are advances in coming up with a cavities vaccine. So they vaccinate you with some antigen that will help break down these carcinogenic.
Wouldn't that be bad news for the dental profession, though?
Yeah.
You know, we have so much work as it is.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's probably true.
Well, yeah, because it's all cosmetic.
Yeah, and there's perio disease, so the disease of the gum that needs to, you know, there's...
Yeah,
we have plenty of work to do. We're not worried about running out of work.
That's cool. That's a cool idea, though. Vaccine.
Yeah,
it's a good idea.
But the other thing the guy was talking about was like doing glycoprotein, or because there's the biofilm is this glyco matrix or polysaccharide matrix, and he was looking at for targets for breaking down these glycopolymers.
Like enzymatically.
Yeah.
Oh,
which would be really cool.
Some sort of thing you could chew on or something that would.
Yeah.
And biofilms are a problem also in medicine, like often in IV and catheters and things like that.
Yeah.
You think you would be able to make something that was fairly specific for, I mean, like an, like you're saying, an enzyme or something that just breaks the. Breaks that stuff down.
But then again, those biofilms have evolved to create a polysaccharide matrix that no one's gonna make an enzyme.
So you need to find like some sort of fungus or something that like
virus
feeds off of
bacteriophage.
But for now, I mean, fluoride's really the way to go for preventing decay.
Yeah.
I mean, just look at a generation ago, like I look at my parents' mouths and you know, they're just completely full of fillings. And, you know, I mean, you're right, we are a different socioeconomic group now, but, like,
you can't stop doing it right now, for sure. I mean, I think there's probably some ways to go. And, yeah, I just remember reading some anthropological studies, some guys, you know, looking at skulls of, like, older humans and, like, just, like, how many of them, like, literally died from, like, you know, oral infections.
Yeah.
Like, apparently it's, like, was super common.
Is it a human thing? Like, do you think animals often have trouble with cavities? Or is it because of our diet? What's... Because, you know, or maybe we died sooner before. And,
I don't know. It might be an age-related thing for sure. Yeah, but...
The other thing is that we have, like, sugars essentially are fuel for these bioplaques, and since we've increased the amount, since we've increased the amount of refined sugar in our diet, that is a huge, huge impact on cavities.
And just living longer, like,
yeah, exactly. I mean, your teeth are designed for 30 years or something, 30-year lifespan, and
What about the use and tear? Like, if you were eating roots and stuff, we used probably to use, you know, would scrape the surface of the teeth and maybe didn't let the biofilms grow or the, you know,
well, even like the kind of grain, like if you eat natural grains and stuff like that, you know, maybe it's.
Whereas now we
have sort of properties that scrape things out of your mouth.
Now we eat like soft food and stuff like that, and maybe just less tear, like wear and tear.
I like everything pureed.
Yeah.
Milkshakes is all.
That's usually what you go to once all your teeth have fallen out.
Yeah. Is there any relationship between like those types of bad, you know, really bad dental infections and like cancer, or these type, like mouth cancers, throat cancers, and that?
Yeah, in terms of cancers, I mean, there's viral lesions that appear, like EBV and all this kind of, and HPV can appear in the mouth. There's a really cool link that just came out with periodontal disease and premature birth for women. So this is, I think it was, there was some quite a large study that was done in the States about using women with periodontal disease, which is essentially an infection in your gums, which can be quite easily treated at the dental office. And by treating periodontal disease, you could prevent premature births by something like 15%, like ridiculous.
Wow. And what's the treatment for that?
It's called root planing and scaling. So it's a generalized debridement of the tissues that surround the teeth. It takes like maybe 2 hours to do. Like if you had a really bad case, every single tooth was infected. Take maybe 2 hours at a dental office. But yeah, this was a, it was a neat, because it was presented again
that would
from
be,
a...
Would that be an anesthetic situation, or...
Yeah, so you...
So then you got to worry about the anesthetic, you know, woman's already pregnant.
That's true, actually.
You know, all that kind of stuff.
But yeah, that's true. You could do it without an anesthetic. It would be not the most comfortable thing in the world, but I've heard of people having it done without it.
They'd probably give labor like right on the spot.
Yeah, yeah.
That'd be super efficient.
But it was interesting because
those
were...
Those chairs are kind of appropriate for giving birth.
Yeah, it's like
you
should set up a, you can set up a dual business.
You can work on both ends.
And do the teeth as it comes out too. I guess they don't have teeth. Never mind.
The vaccine.
You should know. You don't have one.
The cavity.
One of those.
Cool.
Now it's interesting as a public health study because these women. I mean, they wanted basically this treatment to be covered by the government to get women with periodontal disease treated. Because if you do the math, the amount of hospital costs associated with a premature baby was ridiculous. So it's like $5 billion or something absolutely insane they could save by doing this. That's kind of cool.
So which argues like it's too bad it went private because if it was still public, you could find a way to save a bunch of money in the long term. But anyways, that's... Starting to talk like that guy we were talking about yesterday. Anyways.
That's what they want you to do.
Anyways. So, yeah.
You're listening to the Babe Lab podcast.
So let's fire up some posts and to stay on the subject, we could talk about suicide rates in dentistry.
Oh, excellent. Yeah, okay, that's why you're talking. Okay, yeah.
Right, yeah, so this is like a pretty common urban myth or whatever that dentists have the highest suicide rate of any profession, and like, I actually have no idea where it started. Like, do you have any clue how that started?
Yeah, I mean, I remember when I
got in. Are you suicidal? Because you're talking about, you know, this great lifestyle, like, you went into dentistry for this, like, you know, lifestyle down the road, like, being able to, you know, work from home and, you know, run the practice and not, you know, deal with bad breath every day. I mean, and sure, dentistry, I guess, is a profession where, like, you know, your client, like, nobody likes going to the dentist, so I can see, you know, there's probably some stress associated with that, but, like... Do you have any experience, or do you, you know, have any theories as to why that, like, how that might have started?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, obviously, I looked this up as soon as I got in. I did some reviewing as well. It's like, okay, it's not true, thank God. But I think what happens is, going to the dentist, especially for older people, is a very stressful stressful time for them. They're very anxious, you know. How can I? And I think they think, well, if I had to go here every day, I would kill myself. And they think, well, if I was a dentist, I would be here every day, and I would want to kill myself.
I think it's projection.
Yeah, I think so.
It's because people hate going to the dentist, basically.
Yeah, I think so. Or, well, they find it very stressful.
Yeah,
I
mean, yeah.
Some people find it insanely stressful.
Like going to the doctor.
Yeah.
Oh, man, of course it's stressful. I mean, you get, like, I've had a zillion cavities, and they, you know, they freeze you, which sucks. I hate getting frozen.
Yeah.
And then they're drilling away in there. You're just waiting for the fact when it's not frozen, right? And every once in a while, sure enough, yeah. like I've had a cavity where boom, they hit something. Just it's like, haka, give me some more freezing. Yeah. You know, they have, and like, how can that not be stressful?
Yeah.
Yeah. I want, next time you're looking at the person on the dentist chair, just check out their hands on like,
yeah. The oh, yeah, yeah.
Just check out yeah. like the death grip the on
death
those
grip.
No, I'm pretty good now, but I think like
oh yeah. I used to hate the dentist. Yeah. I'm like,
you know, oh, you had braces, right?
I had braces too. Yeah. It was like a dentist's dream, but but I guess like dentists were my nightmare. Like, yeah. but now I'm you know, perfectly good. Like no cavities, whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that's an interesting idea. I guess like you know, if I were to come up with a reason, it would probably be you know that there's some old study that was like not well done that showed that, and then it just sort of like blew up from there. But then once more careful studies were done, like would be my guess. But
yeah, I haven't found any old study or heard of any old study coming out.
Sounds like a strange study at
surprise. Yeah.
Well, not really a study, but you know,
some
you,
stats,
you just like have a statistics about
yeah.
suicide rates among you know. All
it was invented by dentists to get sympathy.
Yeah.
It's conspiracy. That's what they want you to think.
So anyways, on the finance side, it's not true. There is no strong evidence that there is a higher suicide rate among dentists.
And I believe, like, you made actual, like, there's a higher rate among white male American doctors, apparently.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so there have, yeah. Some
that's actually are. True? Or that's a myth too.
So the Straight Dope, which you know is one of these websites like Snopes that tries to like bust these kind of things, like they had this to say: suicide among white male American dentists is higher than the average, but not as high as among doctors. But dentist death rates from other causes are lower, and on average they live several years longer than the general population. But then if you actually go to PubMed and look at you know the literature out there. Basically, it says that, you know, overall, white male dentists have a lower suicide rate than the rest of the working population, although older dentists apparently are more at risk. So once you're living that cushy lifestyle, I guess that's when things start to go to shit. But
you never know if there's some weird thing, too. Like, maybe at one point in practice of medicine or dentistry, if you're using some anesthetic, or even if it was just a small group of people, and one person studied this, and they found that was one weird thing that people were exposed to that was
yeah.
making them all depressed and kill themselves or something.
I could see though how it is more well or quite stressful. I mean my situation's a bit unique in that McGill is quite cheap, but like dental schools in the States, like you're looking at easily $500,000 debt before you're
yeah.
done. And so
Jesus Christ.
Oh man.
Like I know I looked at Harvard for example was $40,000 a year. And then you had to get your instruments on top of that and live. And so if you're $500,000 in debt, you're starting up a new practice, and...
kids are afraid of you.
Yeah. Say you're like, hey, you know, I don't like this so much. What are you going to do?
Yeah. I guess it could be something, too, that, you know, if you, you know, a dentist or a couple yeah. dentists commit suicide, and everyone's like, whoa, what's going on? That's
yeah.
really weird. Like,
yeah.
why would a dentist commit suicide? And the media gets on it, and
yeah,
they start coming up with all these... reasons why, like,
because when a janitor commits suicide, nobody cares.
Yeah, it's true.
It's true.
There's no headline.
So that's one myth busted.
Busted.
I guess.
And I put in the comments that, you know, graduate students apparently have higher suicide rates than undergrads.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, that's an interesting observation also. And when I was working at the Graduate Student Association, I noticed that most of our drug coverage goes to antidepressants. So I wonder if that's a common thing amongst, you know, higher educated people or people that have more debt maybe, or
yeah.
is
well,
a
actually,
common situation
I was
here.
That was maybe just a general rule, like that most prescription
yeah.
drugs
yeah.
in general
are I wouldn't be surprised. I wouldn't
especially
be surprised.
In the long term, like, you know, people take it or are going to take it, like,
yeah.
probably long term, right?
Well, I mean, I don't know very many graduate students who haven't gone through some sort of crisis phase in their, you know,
am I doing the right thing? Should I quit? Kind of.
But like you said in the post too, I mean, like, they're also an older population, different segment of the population too.
Yeah. So, yeah, so they accumulated this debt burden, or you know, like we just talked about, or too, things like that. Cool.
All right.
Move on down. So what's next?
What's
next? We've talked about the mouth. Are we going to talk about the anus? Are we going to go with some farting?
Straight from the mouth to the anus. This is like some sort of porn. Mouth to ass. Yeah. Come on.
It's the other way, actually.
Never mind. So, the other way. Anonymous Coward here was also listening to the Quirks and Quirks podcast. And just sort of like a side note, like somebody they were talking to mentioned that only 30 to 50% of people in the Western world have like produced methane in their farts or have methogenic bacteria in their
But it's not bacteria, right? You said it was.
Exactly. It's not bacteria. It's archaea, which is kind of even cooler. Yeah.
But I definitely thought that everyone that was, you know, that was just a constituent of everyone's farts.
Yeah, so, not everyone produces methane in their farts. Isn't that, like, crazy? Like, didn't you always think that was, like, a huge component of your fart?
Sure.
Yeah. So, like, only that many percentage of people can actually light their farts on fire. So like, you can try and try and try, but you just don't have the right archaea.
Well, I thought the difference was the color of the flame, that methanogenic people had blue flames and the rest had yellow flames. Hence the blue
flame. What are the other flammable components? Apparently, I've read that the only flammable components in a fart is hydrogen, which is usually not at a concentration high enough to actually light.
Okay.
You can't see that burn anyway, can you? No, it's a really, really... Yeah, you can't see it burn.
Yeah. Yeah.
And methane, and that's it.
Okay.
Because, I can't think of any other...
What else would there be?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I don't know.
Carbon dioxide?
Propane?
Yeah, it's carbon dioxide.
What about other...
Is it, like, the main component? Sorry?
What about other alcohols?
Alcohols?
Yeah, like after my rough night last night, could I have lit my urine on fire?
Like Sambuca shots. Yeah.
That's a whole different porn thing.
So, anyways, yeah. Basically, it was just interesting because...
Well, it's all sorts of interesting biological questions if it's a actual...
Yeah,
you know,
for sure.
If
like,
it's an actual thing. Yeah, is it genetic? Is it environmental? Why some people have these archaea?
So this is an interesting like sort of thing that I took out from an old Nature review that talked about this article and a few others. It said that accumulation of hydrogen like gas in the colon lowers the efficiency of microbial fermentation. So the removal of it enhances microbial growth. So... The methogenic bacteria are responsible for removing the hydrogen gas. And so, yeah, so they sort of help bacteria grow in there. So, I don't know. I've also, like, just sort of my brief reading of it, it just sounds like the actual constituents of your gut flora are obviously, like, highly dynamic. So, you know, that's why it's 30 to 50%, is I'm sure that it goes up and down, like, based on whatever. But, so I... But I don't know. I don't know if that means that some people never have it or if it's, like, totally dynamic. I think it's some people never have it.
Yeah. Well, that's weird, like, because, you know, you would think that, you know, two people with a similar diet living in similar conditions would probably get the similar bacteria, like...
Archaea. Yeah, well, I don't know. I actually don't know much about archaea. Are they as transmissible as bacteria? Like, how do those get around?
So members of the same family, like brothers and sisters, siblings, tend to be... There's a correlation. They're either methanogenic or not, right?
Well, yeah.
So
I mean, it's highly...
Yeah, what are the twin studies?
There are twin studies. And on the colonization of the gut flora of the gut. And apparently, they've looked at this, and there is a... There is a difference between twins that are separated in their gut flora, but it is more. They do have more similarities than you know, other people who are.
Yeah,
so your genetics.
It's almost impossible to believe that there's not a genetic, you know, immune sort of polymorphism,
exactly,
and stuff like that.
So your genetics influences the gut flora, but also your environment influences gut flora. And I mean, environment is the big one,
yeah,
but yeah.
I mean, you got to be exposed to, I guess, the right things
to
get them in there in the first place.
Exactly.
just a matter of will they flourish.
So I wonder, like, I mean, to me, like, one of the best ways to transmit it would be like kissing like a girl. Like, I wonder
where,
if, dude. But like, you gotta wonder, if you know, you should really be smelling the farts of your girlfriends before you get involved. Like, I mean, do you really want?
But, yeah. but it's different compounds that make the smell, right? Like,
these are the sulfur-containing compounds, the hydrogen sulfide, obviously being the most likely.
That's interesting too, because we have basically a cultural thing that's like basically the opposite, like. We try to hide our farts from each other, and like, you know, if you're dating, it's like this for a lot of people, like, you have this period where like
you don't fart.
It's like, yeah, you don't acknowledge that you fart. It's like, no, I don't fart. Like, I don't want to like scare this person off. Whatever.
Exactly, because they'll be like, oh man, she has methogenic bacteria or archaea. Like, I'm not gonna, you know.
But no one,
because you realize when at the end of the date, when you kiss, you might get them. So,
but you think there'd be some people that had like some good like farts that just want to be like, yeah, check it out, like, you know.
Yeah. I've got a healthy GI tract.
Be like those birds, you know, like male birds who are showing off their colors. You just be like, yeah.
Yeah, why not show off your healthy intestinal flora?
But it is one of those things, right? Like, you know, a manly belch or, like, you know, like.
Is a stinky fart manly?
Yeah. Well, I don't know if it's stinky, but yeah, for sure. Like, it's like, you know, a hair on your chest kind of thing, no? Like,
really? I don't know. I mean, I guess.
Well, because you don't associate stinky farts with, like, you know, women. Like, I mean, obviously they do have, like, you know, some rancid ones. But
it's interesting though. Back, like, there's something you made you say back there that makes me realize that we're just kind of like big walking bioreactors for, like, all these, you know,
these bacteria that want to integrate.
They're managing like the bioreactor. Like, oh, we need to get this gas out, and like our farting is like, you know, we think of it as like farting. They're like, you know, purging. Like,
well, someone actually said to me, I was listening to one of the things about this gut flora thing, and you actually have more cells of bacteria in or on your body than you do human cells,
yes,
right?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
So
like 10 times more.
So you could say that the genetics of the bacteria are maybe more, or, you know, influential than actually you are. So maybe your bacteria are like, you know, that person's attractive because
could be a good bioreactor. Yeah,
what would be interesting, because it would be, you know, have humans be like co-evolved like with bacteria, right? Like, do we have genetics that have been, you know, for example, selected because they favor bacteria?
So that's interesting, because as part of the Quirks and Quarks,
for sure,
they were talking about methanogenic bacteria being a problem with greenhouse gases and global warming.
Yes.
I am responsible for global warming.
And part of their problem is that cows have these bacteria, and because of their diet, which is high in corn, and instead of being high in grass like they should be, they fart a lot.
Yeah.
So is the same true in cows? Is it like 30 to 50%
no,
of cows?
No, all cows. And the thing is, kangaroos don't have methanogenic bacteria, and they were talking about perhaps like trying to inoculate them with the kangaroo bacteria.
Because the kangaroo have an additional bacteria that utilizes like
the methane
in a different way so that they don't produce methane.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, it's like adding an additional like biochemical process in the intestine of the cow to prevent release of methane for, like, you know, greenhouse effect bone benefits, which is like, you know, I just love the fact that like this whole like global warming thing has gotten down to like doing cool stuff like this. Like, that is cool.
Yeah.
If you reduce like the cow impact on
I think that I would be worried about, like, what are the ecological consequences of introducing foreign bacteria into that ecosystem.
But the ecosystem of the cow? That's not an ecosystem. That's a managed agricultural thing.
Yeah, that's our food supply.
Is it an ecosystem?
It's a food supply that, I mean, it's a big ecosystem because we have so many of them and we keep them around.
I think part
they
of the
interact
problem,
with the grass that they
to
eat.
To me, an
and
ecosystem
the
is something that like exists in like a self-contained system, not a.
What do you mean self-contained?
Man
isn't part of an ecosystem. Like, are we not biological?
I don't think that like we operate in a sustainable way. I don't think we classify.
That's what they want you to think.
Thank you.
What do you mean? But like cows aren't like I'm sustainable. Like I'm gonna like not eat. Like I'm gonna, you know, my pasture is limited. I'm gonna be sustainable in terms of how I'm eating grass. Like, other animals don't participate in sustainable practices. They balance each other, like, as an ecosystem.
Yeah, because it's an ecosystem, exactly.
Well, which we are part of. How are you suggesting that we decoupled ourselves from eco by
diseases?
Everything we live in. How are we different? Like, how do we decouple ourselves from ecosystems so we don't rely on, you know, ecosystems?
Because I don't think we're part of a system that is balanced right now. I think that an ecosystem
maybe found the boundary, right? Like,
I don't think our behavior,
we haven't reached our equilibrium yet. Maybe.
Maybe. Yeah.
Sure.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sure. Sure, I buy that.
But I mean,
we're an unbalanced ecosystem.
But equilibrium, like, nothing is in equilibrium static. I mean, they're dynamic, right? Equilibrium.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you look at your lifetime and what happens,
too short.
It looks different, but
yeah.
I mean, we're in some sort of a equilibrium.
Yeah. I don't know if we're part of it.
So, anyway, we were talking about
cows. As a side note about farting.
So, I can't believe it's only second beer conversation. You guys are drinking Coke.
It's really strong.
So there's a website that's linked in that post that has facts about farting.
It is a fantastic website.
It is. I honestly haven't laughed that hard in a long time. I was doubled over and I was having like asthma attacks. It was just way
tears.
Too funny. Tears streaming down my face.
He even
facts
let a
on
go
farts.
A while he
Yeah, it's one of the posts on Babe Lab. The link is called Facts on Farts. It's ridiculous.
And so they answer all the great fart questions there.
Yes.
Like, what were some examples?
So some examples just off the top of my head. One of them is like, you know, like it's set up like a sort of right into like the fart master kind of like style. And it's like, one of them is like, you know, why can I taste farts? What is it in farts that I can taste? And like, another one is,
why do your own farts smell good?
Yeah. Another one is like, why do I hear farts before I smell them? And the answer is like, well, if farts traveled at the speed of sound, indeed, you would smell them at the same time you would.
Diffusion coefficient on methane in air.
Anyways, it's classic. And it's like, and it's old school HTML. It's probably like 100 pages long. I've read a tenth of it.
Yeah,
and it's
but that is a throwback to the glory days of the internet.
For sure.
So, Rob, I have a question for you, though, because, I mean, I know you've always been a fart guy, and, you know, it's interesting. But,
it's your primary research.
You know, do you think your interest in farts lately has been influenced at all by, like, the fact that you've been dealing with a lot of poo, and, like, drinking with poo? Like, have you ever thought about, like...
Oh, I've definitely thought about the colonization.
What's going on here?
And, like,
with
how,
kangaroo?
Yeah. How, like, his... So I have an infant, and like the consistency of like the feces situation is just like so bizarre. It just changes, and like why it's changing, and like is it normally changing?
It's weird that it changes because it's like
the diet
on a
is the
singular
same.
Diet.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
it eats heat.
Exactly.
Eats one thing.
Exactly. So it changes over time because of just its colonization. Like. Because you start out totally sterile, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and most of your feces is made of bacterial matter, I think.
Is that right?
I don't know. Maybe most is an overstatement, but a good percentage of like your feces is bacterial matter.
Huh. That's probably right.
Huh. That'd be an interesting project, a way of looking at, you know, the colonization process is to take samples, like, in a developing,
system.
I previously
linked in a previous post that
something
actually
was,
links to,
yeah.
about, like, a PLOS paper about, like, how guts are colonized. And you actually start off as an infant because you're sterile. And it's totally environmental. Everybody starts off quite differently as an infant because of the way you colonize. But you do converge on a more similar adult flora. So.
It's interesting that, you know, our gut is obviously exposed to a lot of food and things we take in, like bacteria. And we have this sort of presumably coevolution or this sort of like almost commensal or mutually beneficial relationship, symbiosis that happens. And, you know, most of these things don't cause disease normally. And yeah, we were just talking about with teeth, how pathological, like, yes, it's a similar situation of these bacteria colonizing us and they just like kick the crap out of
like, maybe there's like positive mouths, bacteria, you know? That you could put in the mouth that would fight the,
the
bad ones. Yeah, you could inoculate your mouth with positive bacteria.
Probiotic.
Well, I wonder if there's anything we did.
Does Bobby have to take like supplements or anything like that? Because, you know, so for example, vitamin K is
well, it's a vitamin, so it's like necessary, and it's involved in, you know, blood clotting and whatever. But that's something that you don't need to take as a, you know, from an exogenous source, because your gut bacteria produces vitamin K. And so does, like, you know, so Bobby pre-colonization, like, is breast milk rich in vitamin K, or is there, you know, does he have to actually take supplements to milk, or?
So, Bobby being the infant, he doesn't take in any supplements of any kind, because, you know, I think the sort of problem with, like, the whole thing is that everybody talks about, you know, breast milk as being the solution to everything, and, like, there's this big, like, sort of natural idea about breast milk being, you know,
natural,
having everything.
It's
in
better.
Yeah, it's natural. It has everything, and he's been breastfed for whatever. But the one thing that he does have to take is vitamin D. So apparently, you don't get enough vitamin D from breast milk. But that's it. Apparently, you
get
everything
from milk.
Well, yeah, no, but
the one that they
it's added
to
milk. A and D
milk,
are like,
yeah, something.
So, but plus it's winter and he's bundled up all the time, so he doesn't get the sunlight.
Yeah, I don't know why vitamin D. I don't know if it's a sun exposure thing or if they just assayed breast milk and said, oh, it has no vitamin D, you must need, you know.
Well,
I don't,
milk in general doesn't, like, that's why it's added to, well, I mean, I guess
that's not why it's added. It's probably a public health
thing.
Yeah,
yeah, but I mean, it's added to milk, like, it's,
yeah.
But how did, like,
milk isn't a rich source.
Pre-supplementation human infants get their vitamin D? Like, is it, like you're saying, maybe it's a sunlight thing, I guess.
Oh, it's just an overall health thing,
yeah,
I'm sure.
I mean, one of these things where they survive fine, but they survive better.
Yeah, yeah.
What is it? Vitamin D prevents rickets or something like that?
Yeah.
Is that what it is? Which is...
What is rickets?
It's like softening.
Yeah, it's
softening the bones.
You get, like, bow-legged.
Do you get teeth problems as well?
Yeah, you get, like, you get all kinds of funky... Basically, your body can't absorb the calcium, if I recall.
Yeah, it has to do with calcium.
That's right. Yeah.
So calcium deficiency.
Which is probably why milk is what's supplemented and not, you know, bread or whatever.
Yeah, maybe. So that was, like, good, like,
so
part of feces.
The vitamin K, but...
Yeah, I don't know very much about it.
All right, let's start this up. What's the next post? Oh, it's my post, so I don't have access.
It's the vacuum cleaner.
All right, so...
It's actually up a bit.
Case report.
Let's use the scroll bar, dude.
No, it's not working. Oh, it's because you kind of highlighted the page.
What?
I'm off page for whatever reason.
All right, so this post is entitled, "What is it with men and vacuum cleaners?" And I'm sure, like...
He was just subconsciously trying to seal my beard.
So I'm sure you must have heard before of, like, somebody pleasuring himself with a vacuum cleaner.
You've heard of somebody?
I've heard of. So if you ever seen the Arrested Development episode where he sleeps with the Roomba?
Yeah.
And, like, it's sort of a popular thing of, like, urban legend of, like, men pleasuring themselves with the vacuum cleaner.
There was apparently some rumor of some guy in high school who, like, did a vacuum cleaner, actually. But anyways.
I gotta say, it feels way better than a broom.
So I was recently listening to the Darwin Award creator talking on the podcast, saying that, you know, one of her favorite is, like, a man who was trying to pleasure himself with a vacuum cleaner and ended up losing his reproductive organs, so he's basically outside of the gene pool, you know, now. So, and I was sort of interested, like, is this a common thing? Is this something real? So I looked it up on PubMed, and of course, I found, like, a million different case reports of vacuum cleaner related injuries, and the frequency of which, like, astounded me. So, in one particular journal of the European Urology Journal, out of 48 masturbation related injuries,
I love it. Second, what are the other ones too?
Chain on the wall here.
Sort of like the other ones, though. Like, okay, I mean, continue, but, like. 12, so what is it? 12 out
of... 12 are inserting objects into the urethra.
Okay.
So people sticking stuff up there.
That is also surprising.
Yes. I don't know why anybody would want to do that. And then you've got 36 that are related to vacuum cleaners.
Holy shit.
So the bulk of masturbation-related injuries have to do with vacuum cleaners.
That is crazy. Because it's just off topic. I know somebody who worked as an x-ray technician for quite a while, and they said that they had quite a few cases
of foreign objects.
And maybe that's not too classified under masturbation or something.
But then it wouldn't be in the urology.
You're right.
It would be
right.
GI thing.
Sorry, you're right. Okay.
You kind of wonder if they misinterpret the urethra thing too, right? They're just like, oh, they're just trying to get off. Like maybe they're like trying to catheterize themselves because they don't want to go in the hospital or something.
Like, I'm too lazy to get out of bed.
With a big pen and a...
Oh. I don't think it's that pleasant, but...
Oh.
Yeah, well, apparently it's 12 out of 48.
I can't imagine doing
but
it unless you're
36 ready. Out of 48 are from fucking vacuum cleaners?
Right, and the thing is, what is it with a vacuum cleaner? So, okay, it creates a vacuum, but other than that, like, what's the pleasurable part of that? I don't quite get it. And second, how come there's blades in the vacuum cleaner? So I was unaware there were blades in there.
Yeah, it's a good thing you told me before I started masturbating.
No, so there's rotating blades in there.
Finally, your vacuum's getting some use.
Is that an urban myth you made up just to try and, like, promote safety, like, to prevent people from doing this?
And then another thing is, like, before sticking your junk into this, why don't you, like, try something else? Like, make sure there's, like,
enough room.
Yes, first of all.
I know, I find most of those vacuum hoses are too small for me, so.
Yeah, like, the girth
industrial
on those
strength.
But.
So I've got.
Shop back.
I've got a theory that maybe.
Sorry.
Alright. I've got a theory that maybe it's impotent men. Because, like, under a vacuum.
Wait, so other vacuum.
Under a vacuum, it's possible for impotent men to, like, get an erection. So I wonder if it's, like, the way for impotent men to masturbate.
So you think that you know, the majority of the 36 are impotent males?
That's what I wonder.
I think it's basically just man's, you know, inborn desire to have sex with a robot.
Yeah, maybe it's a fetish, with, like, having sex with machines.
That is awesome. I wonder if there's any, like, I mean, dude, there's every, like, pornography fetish in the world. I wonder. Did you ever check it out?
Robot sex?
Yeah, robot sex is out there for sure.
But well, maybe, that's, like, I mean, we don't have functional androids. Like, we've got Roomba is, like, the next best thing.
Yeah.
Maybe it's limiting, though. I mean, you maybe say something, you said something before that made me wonder if, like, this is an evolutionary explanation for why, like, men don't vacuum clean. Because we've selected against people, like, men who have an affinity for vacuum cleaning.
Well, okay, so if you actually...
Because, like, we're selecting for people that are afraid of using a vacuum. Like, just the image of a vacuum turns them off.
But no, it makes sense. Because if you read, like, so there there are some case reports. And basically all of them involve some, like, a man who was vacuuming with a loose-fitting garment or in the nude, who was bending over to unplug it when... By accident, fell into the vacuum.
So let me read some because
the excuses are brilliant.
This is just too funny.
Really, okay, should not vacuum.
read the excuses.
Okay, so case report one: a 60-year-old man said that he was changing the plug of his Hoover Dustet vacuum cleaner in the nude while his wife was out shopping. It turned itself on and caught his penis, causing tears around the external and, like, deeply lacerating the side of the glands. So somehow it turned itself on. He was by himself, vacuuming in the nude.
Vacuums are known to do that. They turn themselves on. They're self-aware.
Why would you vacuum the clothes on? I mean, really?
All right. I love this one. Like, a 49-year-old man was vacuuming his friend's staircase in a loose-fitting dressing gown.
So
when
he's at his friend's place.
He's naked at his friend's place vacuuming, first of all. So this is like... And then, intending to switch the machine off, he leaned across to reach the plug, and at that moment, his penis was sucked into the vacuum cleaner. Are we expected to believe that?
Do you think vacuum cleaner design has ever been influenced by, like, I don't know, trying to prevent this or enhance?
That's a new way to market a vacuum cleaner.
Imagine there's some, like, religious sort of family groups, too, that might be, like, you know...
Anti-vacuum
cleaner. We have to design the anti-male vacuum cleaner.
Maybe that's why they have blades in them, because, like, I don't understand the blades.
But
like,
they don't tell anybody, though. They're not,
what,
like,
are the blades,
like,
in a...
Monster blade chopper, like... 2000 or something.
What is up with blades in a vacuum cleaner? What are they cutting up? I don't understand that.
Yeah, big chunks. I don't know.
Maybe you're thinking of like a sawduster or something. Like a...
Yeah. That's crazy.
So it's actual metal, so, like, chopping blades. It's not, you know, because some of them have like the rotating brush or whatever.
For,
like,
carburetors, right?
Yeah. So, like, is that what they're calling a blade? Or is it actually, like, you know, if I were to vacuum
cabbage, I'd come out with coleslaw at the other side.
What about, like, do you think that...
Zach could save you some time.
He said, like, what
is... Phobie. You just use your vacuum.
He said, what is it about vacuum cleaners, too? Like, well, I mean, what about, like, you know, lots of guys have, like, lots of carpentry equipment and stuff like that that has, like... suction and power tools and stuff like that. Like, I wonder if there's any case reports on that.
Well, yeah, you're probably less inclined to use like a power saw or a nail gun.
Ooh, to catheterize.
It's a little more obvious that those things are dangerous.
Man,
that's weird.
That's messed up, but it makes me wish I had a vacuum.
Basically, that comes down to good old PubMed. Like, PubMed is awesome for like finding that stuff. Also, one of our most popular posts that you've also posted, it's in a similar vein, is like the whole getting your crotch stuck in a zipper.
That's right.
That was a good post too, and that got a lot of hits. Like that was
PubMed is a gold mine.
PubMed is a gold mine of hilarious.
Those medical, some of those medical anecdotes are just crazy.
Yeah. So there you go, guys. Don't vacuum in the nude. And,
yeah, so Rob, when you were away, I was vacuuming your place. I sort of fell over.
And be careful of blades.
All right. Hit it, Rob.
You've been listening to the Babe Lab Podcast, episode number
17.
I'm Rob.
I'm
drinking
Camel.
Stella.
I'm DAC.
I'm Babe Man.
So we got to thank our sponsors in Vitrogen, Jamie Coronaldi for the sound and music,
and our host Humphreys, I guess.
Yeah, Humphreys,
which
they have great
don't have their password for their Wi-Fi yet. But anyways, good beer. All
right, and this has been the best looking podcast of the internet.
I'm getting
just to make it clear, it's not the best looking science podcast. It's the best looking podcast, period.
And getting better looking by the minute. As we drink beer.
Now I've got to go back in.
I mean, I think something, you know, it's interesting to talk about poo and like early agriculture and seeds and that practice being started by people pooing different places and like realizing that things grew out of them.
Yeah.
You know?
That was in Guns, Germs, and Steel, right?
Yeah, Guns, Germs, and Steel. So I had this theory because I was thinking, like, okay, we're talking about poo. And so I gotta see what you guys think of this theory. So I don't know. I think that, you know, if you look at poo, like, people really have a strong ability to, like, discriminate different types of poo. You know? Like, I think you're really sensitive. Like, if your poo is off or you've eaten something different, like, you can totally pick up on it. Like, our brains maybe have evolved. Maybe there's been selection at some point for people being, like, it's like facial recognition, right? Like, we're really good.
Fecal recognition.
Fecal recognition. Like, because we're really good. Like, it's important for us, like, socially to be able to pick up faces. And like, you know, it's not just like, you know, you can recognize a face better than you can recognize
and maybe,
a hand.
Or maybe something. Out in the wild, you can recognize like whose poo it was when you come across it.
So like, it's one thing is illness, like, you know, maybe it's important to like deal
important
with
to
illness.
Know your illness, yeah.
And also like things you've been eating, and like maybe people started out agriculture as like being experts in poo,
And, like, they would go through, like, because the first thing would be, like, oh, like, you know, we're pooling places and things are growing and sometimes there's something good. But, like, how do we know, like, how do we get the good stuff? And then maybe people, like, started cultivating and, like, to keep track of poo and, like, became poo scientists and, like, started, like, picking out different seeds and learning, like, all the different things, like, they could recognize. And maybe they're just, like, experts in, I don't know, maybe that's where some of the... Maybe there was an advantage, like, I don't know.
Fertilizer?
At some point. Yeah.
It is, like, yeah. I mean, because some poos, I don't, like, you know, you don't, like, we care when a dog shits on our, you know, lawn or whatever, but
yeah.
Fertilize with cow poo or whatever, like, so if human poo, like, we start selling it as a fertilizer?
Well, yeah, dude, they used to, like, they used to use that in the Middle Ages and
maybe there was selection. You can't use it as a fertilizer, like an industrial scale, because it stinks way too bad. Like, even places where they use horse manure or cow manure. Dude,
I mean,
in comparison, it is mild.
But maybe because of agriculture, for agricultural reasons too, maybe it was an advantage for people, like, if people had beneficial combinations of gut flora that produced, like, fertilizer-like things that helped the seeds that they were shitting to grow, then maybe that was, like, good for the development of agriculture, and therefore those people were, like, selected for, and maybe that's influences our gut colonization too.
Interesting theory.
But to look at the fossil evidence.
Fossil evidence.